Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. When you hear people talk about being mindful, what does that mean to you? Does it mean paying attention, slowing down, and reconnecting? Or does it mean tapping a smartphone app and racking up the meditation minutes? As goes with any new way of thinking, popularization means success, but commercialization as well, and dilution. It was 40 years ago when Jon Kabat-Zinn introduced Americans to mindfulness first. He opened the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Clinic in 1979. And in a later book, he wrote, "Ultimately, I see mindfulness as a love affair with life, with reality and imagination, with the beauty of your own being, with your heart and body and mind, and with the world." If that sounds like a lot to take in, it is. So this hour on Point, we'll talk with Jon Kabat-Zinn about his view of America's embrace of mindfulness now. And you can join us. What is it that you'd like to know about mindfulness? Do you try to bring this practice into your life? What has been your experience? Or are you still a little skeptical of the idea? Join us anytime online at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, Jon Kabat-Zinn joins us today from Springfield, Massachusetts. He founded the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Clinic in 1979, which became the Center for Mindfulness in Medicine, Healthcare, and Society at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He is author of many books, including Wherever You Go, There You Are, Mindfulness for Beginners, and Mindfulness for All, The Wisdom to Transform the World. Jon Kabat-Zinn, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. It's great to be here.
It's very good to have you. First of all, let me just...
I hear your voice all the time, so it's very sweet to actually connect with this.
Well, I hope it's not a nightmarish voice in your dreams, but rather...
No, it's wonderful.
Good. Well, I wanted to begin right now in the present, before we reach back into the past to talk about this idea that you've brought to the nation. When you hear popular discourse about mindfulness now, when you hear it discussed in the media, or you see those ads for all those mindfulness apps, are people talking about it in the right way? Do we understand what mindfulness is?
That's a wonderful question. And the answer is, I think, and I wrote a paper with this title for the scientific literature, it's too early to tell. Mindfulness has so many profound elements and dimensions to it that for it to be integrated into mainstream Western society is going to take multiple generations. The success, of course, of anything often comes with a good deal of hype at a certain point. And people, you know, throw their hats into the arena just because it's popular or just because it's commercially exploitable, and then that has the potential to degrade the essence of what its potential is for us. So yeah, there's a lot of hype out there about mindfulness now, and of course there increasingly are a lot of apps. But you know, we live in the digital age, so everything's going to have to basically migrate to apps, and then we're going to have to become mindful of how to not let the app become imprisoning to us.
I mean, that's a meta level analysis of mindfulness in the 21st century. But since you mentioned all of these apps, if I may, I just want to play a little bit of an ad for one of these meditation apps. This is from a 2018 television commercial for the app Calm, and it features user testimonials about how well the app has worked for them.
When I open the app, it's an instant sense of relaxation.
Calm taught me to appreciate things as they are right now, and that to me was a gift.
I actually noticed I was sleeping better.
I now sleep 8 hours a day, and that's even with the toddler in the house.
Is it weird that an app changed my life? Because it did.
Jon Kabat-Zinn, full disclosure, I use a meditation app every day quite frequently.
Wonderful.
It's not Calm. It's a different one. And I have to say, okay, it has made a difference in my life.
Yeah.
But the reason
why
I wanted to play this piece of tape here is especially that first line of the woman who said, "When I open the app, it's an instant sense of relaxation." And this is what I wanted to explore with you. I feel like because of the commercialization now, are people unknowingly feeling that they can just take shortcuts to mindfulness, whereas what's really demanded, and you've been saying this for 40 years, is a deep and prolonged practice.
Yes, but I think anything that gets you in the door is going to have to suffice for the moment. And then presumably, the more you do have that feeling of calm or balance or equanimity, the more it becomes your what we would call in neuroscience, your default mode. So that's your kind of go-to position instead of stress reactivity when the proverbial stuff starts to hit the proverbial fan. So all of those things that you, sort of heard people saying, I hear very similar things from people who've gone through the 8-week fairly intensive MBSR stress reduction program in the clinic at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center and medical centers around the world now. They speak very much that way, and especially saying this saved my life or changed my life. I just came back from Austria and hundreds of people were saying that to me, all in translation, you know. And so there's a certain way in which I didn't invent mindfulness. It's been around for thousands of years, and it's very, very profound. And at this particular time on the planet when we're, I think, really facing evolutionary challenges of enormous import and accelerating in terms of time at an incredible rate, we need something to actually help us connect with what's deepest and best in ourselves as human beings. And mindfulness can actually deliver on that because it really is boundless. And the other thing, if you don't mind my saying this right off the bat, is that it's not about acquiring anything, because mindfulness is really a synonym for awareness. And everybody already has awareness as a profound, let's call it a kind of intelligence, a form of intelligence. But we never get trained in how to access that intelligence in school or at home. So it's kind of haphazard until you stumble across it, say, once you've had, you know, chronic medical problems or something like that, and your doctor refers you to a mindfulness-based program of one kind or another.
Right.
But this 40 years is, I think, really the beginning of a much longer trajectory of bringing meditative awareness and wisdom and greater cultivation of the capacities for paying attention and cultivating moment-to-moment awareness in an open-hearted way, that we're just basically at the beginning of something that hopefully will spread in not just American society but worldwide, and it seems to be. And the real challenge is, will it be corrupted or not, as you're pointing to? And my hope is that people will people are not stupid, and so they can figure out pretty quickly when things are hype or when they're not, and that the benefits will so outweigh the personal benefits, to say nothing of the family and social benefits, because there are those too, will so far outweigh the sort of low-level hype that people will ground themselves in that and continue to practice.
It lifts my spirit to hear you say that this practice, which is, as you rightfully say, is thousands of years old, can be a place for hope and refuge from the demands of that modern life is putting on all of us.
But, well, I was thinking of when you just made the transition from what you were talking about before about the news of the week, and now you're going to mindfulness. It struck me that that would require a huge kind of degree of mindfulness and on your part to be able to make such a rapid transition to a whole other, you know, domain of the mind, and yet at the same time maintain balance, equanimity, clarity. That's its own sort of form of practice, so to speak.
Now you are showering me with undeserved accolades here, John Kabat-Zinn. So I'm gonna say it. Thank you for that, but I'll put it aside for the moment.
Yeah. I'm saying that not for you, but for your listeners, because you know if you can do something like that, then we can all learn to, in some sense, make transitions more gracefully and not get caught up in just being lost in thought or reactivity or the heaviness of the kinds of things we often carry around with us.
Well, what I wanted to ask you was, because of the success of the idea that you introduced 40 years ago, we do hear this phrase, mindfulness, a lot. And I think it's just worth taking a moment for you to remind us, when we say mindfulness, what exactly do we mean? What is
it? Thank you. Okay. So, first of all, mindfulness is a regular English word, you know, that's been adopted by certain translators of ancient Buddhist texts. And so the word in Pali, which was the original language in which the Buddha's teachings were written down, is sati, and that was translated as mindfulness or satipanya, which means open awareness or clear comprehension. So what mindfulness really is awareness, pure and simple. And as I was suggesting earlier, awareness has not gotten anywhere near the degree of attention as a form of human intelligence that we really need to give it at this particular juncture on the planet. And my working definition of mindfulness, because people say, well, awareness or pure awareness, what does that – that doesn't help much.
And awareness
and
of what?
Yeah, exactly. And so I'll also say, if they want a one-word definition, mindfulness is relationality. In other words, how are we to be, or how will we be, or how are we in relationship to, and then you fill in the blank. We say things like my body, my mind, my anger, my upset, my job. But very often we don't know who the my is, because we haven't really been attending to who we are. And so we're in relationship to the body when, hey, I thought we, in a sense, we don't have a way to language this, but we are the body. How is the body not me? Or how is my mind not me? But you can't point to it, but you can point to the body. So my operational definition of mindfulness is that it's the awareness that arises from paying attention on purpose in the present moment and non-judgmentally.
Well, Jon Kabat-Zinn, stand by for just a moment. We are talking about 40 years of this concept and practice of mindfulness that Jon Kabat-Zinn introduced to Americans back in 1979. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Jon Kabat-Zinn. 40 years ago, he created the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Clinic at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He introduced this idea of mindfulness to America. And now, 4 decades later, we have everything from mindfulness being taught in corporate America to schools to prisons to, yes, apps on your phones. What is your question for Jon Kabat-Zinn? And, you know, we actually have several callers already who want to join us, John. So if I may, let me just bring some of them in. Jay is calling from Dayton, Ohio. Jay, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to say that I was so excited today when I heard that this was the subject of On Point. I started after a traumatic loss when I was in high school to study what was, you know, interpersonal communication at the time. And Dr. Byram Robinson, one of my professors, taught us the notion of being here and now, not there and then. And it's turned out in the last 40 years of my life, as I've grown and learned things, it all comes down to being present and being here and now. And that's something that's so difficult to stay on the, you know, on the balance beam, to keep that here and now. But it does take practice. And I'm so glad that you're doing this work and have been. Wondering, how do we make this stick? I don't want it to be a – I mean, when I would say things like this back in the day, people say, oh, there you go with your psychobabble. I'd say now I'm afraid it's going to be a fad, and people are going to be like, oh, here you go with that mindfulness stuff, which to me has been life-saving and life-changing.
Yeah. Well, Jay, thank you so much for your call. John, how would you like to respond to him?
Well, I guess the first thing I'd say is that in terms of the question of making it stick, a lot of, you know, fads have come and gone, but none of them have had as much scientific support and evidence marshaled to actually demonstrate its effectiveness as mindfulness, and in particular MBSR, but other forms of mindfulness cultivation as well. So the only reason we're having this conversation 40 years after, you know, I started the stress reduction clinic is because of all the scientific studies that have gone on that actually held the practice to a very high standard and asked, well, does it actually affect people or not? Because anecdotal, you know, reports of patients getting better in medicine are very, of course, widespread and extremely important because that's your personal experience. But in order for it to be valid in scientific or circles or medical circles, it really has to be supported by studies. And this is. So in that sense, I think that's one of the draws for people is that they can count on this and it's not just somebody selling them snake oil. But when it comes right down to it, what the caller said is absolutely true. It is a practice. And rather than calling it a concept or an idea or a thought, you know, the thought of mindfulness or your concept of mindfulness, the way I've come to think of it is that mindfulness is really a way of being. Actually, as I said, a way of being in relationship. And our whole life is being in relationship inwardly and outwardly, but we're never really aware of it. It's almost as if we're zoning along on autopilot a lot of the time, getting through our moments to get to the end of something or to onto a better moment. And if you continue to do that your whole life, you could zip into your grave without actually having experienced very much. So in that sense, it requires exercising a certain muscle that all human beings can do. And that's a really beautiful thing, is that this is about as universal, because it has to do with attention and awareness. It's really a universal capacity, and it's not like we have to cultivate awareness because we're born with it. Yeah. So we don't need to get anything, but we need to cultivate access to our own awareness and learn to trust it by inhabiting it.
So John, let me ask you, though, I'm going to kind of bumble through this question a little bit, so forgive me. But
no worries.
I still want to explore with you your analysis of how our notions, our popular notions of mindfulness are being used in the culture. And here's why I say that. Because we have a comment that's come in from Hannah, who says, I've had mindfulness shoved down my throat as a chronic pain patient without clinicians having any idea of what it entails. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, mindfulness became code for your pain isn't my problem in the medical setting.
Oh, wow.
So that's one example. And a sort of a related example is, you know, every time I think of all the corporations who say, here, take, you know, we're going to give you mindfulness apps for free, it might be a way to assist people to manage the stress of their working lives. But on the other hand, is it a way for that same corporation to say, well, what we're not going to do is fix the structural problems that are causing your stress.
Exactly, or raise your salary.
Exactly. We're going to put it on you to find a sense of awareness and peace on your own.
Right. Well, you're pointing to the shadow side of things, and I'm very happy that you're bringing that up, because it's inevitable that this kind of thing is going to happen whenever anything becomes really mainstream and available to everybody, that it will be basically framed in those kinds of ways. There's an enormous amount of good that's happening in the business world with mindfulness, but then we also have to ask can we examine the business and see whether, you know, it's actually utilizing mindfulness to exploit both its workers or to exploit its customers or to, you know, in some sense just, you know, funnel more money to capitalists that don't need it or investors that don't need it, that it brings up all sorts of questions about ethics and morality that are actually exactly what our society needs at the moment in order to find a new way to be in this very rapidly changing era we find ourselves in, where pretty much everything is going to be run by algorithms and computer systems. And the real question is, like, what's going to happen to the humans when, you know, and we're talking about this already with driverless trucks and driverless cars and, well, what's going to happen to all the truck drivers? So these are very big issues. And I really, I want to just say something about the woman who was treated right so badly by her medical team with for chronic pain, was saying, you know, mindfulness is one more way, but it's only a complement to medical treatment. It's not a substitute for medical treatment. That's iatrogenic. That's criminal in a certain way to treat a medical patient like that, or to shame them into saying, well, if you were just more mindful, you'd be able to live with your pain or you wouldn't have that pain. That's exactly the way to set it up so that the power of mindfulness could never be experienced by her. Mm. So it has to be set up. You quoted me as saying that it's a love affair in a certain way. I'm not joking about that or just being absurdly idiotic or romantic. I really feel that in many ways we can live our whole lives, as Thoreau very eloquently observed in Walden, without ever connecting with what's deepest and best and most beautiful in ourselves, and then stringing that element of who we are together to make a life that you know, is really profoundly satisfying and that contributes to the larger good of the society.
Yeah. So I cannot resist asking you the following question, because every time I hear you speak and, you know, I think about the fact that you have been practicing mindfulness for more than 40 years, right? I imagine
more than 50 years.
Does Jon Kabat-Zinn walk around in this constant nirvana-esque beatific state of grace? I mean, is that
no? You should ask my children or my grandchildren or my wife. You know, no. The whole point is to be a regular person, but to be who you actually are. And then, if things like impatience or irritability or anger come up or sadness or whatever, to hold them in awareness and not make a big story of it. Because very often, when we get caught in our emotions, then we act really unintelligently. And so mindfulness is actually at the absolute root of what's called emotional intelligence these days, that Daniel Goleman was so instrumental in bringing into the fore of things, and that now is taught in schools throughout the country and the world. So no, it's not about being some kind of like saint or saint-like figure or beatific figure. It's about being real, Magna. It's about living your life, not somebody else's, as if it really, really, really mattered. And then you say, well, I don't know how I would do that. Great. That not knowing is an extremely important part of mindfulness, awareness of not knowing. So awareness involves knowing, but it also involves, extremely importantly, knowing when you don't know. And mostly, we don't know when we don't know, and then we get caught in all sorts of reactivity of one kind or another because we're grasping at what we think we need and pushing away what we are frightened of or don't want, and we're always off balance and stressed, and then think that's the normal state of affairs. Mm-hmm. And I would call that mindlessness.
Mindlessness. Okay. Well, Jon Kabat-Zinn, stand by here for just a second, because I do want to introduce another guest in this conversation to talk about some of the interesting and surprising and powerful ways that mindfulness has been introduced into places that perhaps we wouldn't initially think of. So Rhonda McGee joins us now from San Francisco. She's a professor of law at the University of San Francisco. Her teaching is focused on mindfulness-based stress reduction interventions for lawyers, law students, and for minimizing social identity-based bias. And she's author of the forthcoming book, The Inner Work of Racial Justice, Healing Ourselves and Transforming Our Communities Through Mindfulness. That's coming out in September. Rhonda McGee, welcome to On Point.
Hi, it's good to be with you, Meghna. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for joining us today. So tell us...
Hi, Rhonda.
Hello, John. It's wonderful to be in conversation with you.
Tell us a little bit about how this idea of mindfulness, how you're introducing it into your work and into law and this idea of minimizing identity-based bias.
Well, you know, again, as John was, as the two of you have been discussing, for me, it really is more than an idea. It's really about creating opportunities for us to experience ourselves in these more real and authentic ways through various kinds of practices. So, you know, in the work that I do, in, which is based in law, my full-time job is as a full-time law professor, tenured law professor at the University of San Francisco, and it expands beyond that, but certainly with law and in the classroom spaces where I introduce these practices, I sometimes use language of mindfulness, and sometimes I simply create opportunities for us to experience the present, the moments that we're in ways that give those in the course with me an opportunity to have their own experience of what mindfulness is. And I introduce these practices and these opportunities in ways that are aligned with, you know, the particular challenges of the work that we're doing. So just as one example for lawyers and law students, communication is so essential. Mm-hmm. Everything that we do is often, you know, in some real sense, going to result in or begins with some kind of opportunity to have a real conversation with somebody about something that matters. And so that often is in person, but sometimes it's communication remotely, it's written communication. And so an important part of how I bring mindfulness into a kind of a concrete experiential moment for my law students and folks in law is to create spaces for exploring what mindful communication looks
right,
like.
Right.
And there are many different programs that support that. One, in addition to, you know, having experiences of interpersonal mindfulness in a basic mindfulness-based stress reduction kind of course class setting, you know, there are these trainings. Just as one example, Gregory Kramer is a teacher who has developed a process, a program, an approach called Insight Dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just another kind of a way of infusing all of the things that you and John have been speaking yeah. about into a kind of a way of thinking about how we can bring moments of pause, moments of openness, or relaxation, as Gregory puts it, but just kind of pausing, relaxing, accepting what is present with as little judgment as possible as we participate in connecting and communicating with other people.
Right.
Yeah. So that's just one place where I bring it in.
Jon Kabat-Zinn, are you surprised? Or maybe not. But are you surprised by how Rhonda is incorporating mindfulness into her field of expertise?
No, I love it. And Rhonda and I have worked together in the past and will be in the future. I think this is the kind of natural unfolding of the arc of mindfulness in the world. Again, it's actually quite an ancient meditation practice. But the real meditation practice is life itself. And so mindfulness is of virtually no use unless you can bring it into virtually anything, from doing the dishes to arguing a case in front of a judge and a jury. So awareness and the sort of deep clarity that comes with it and calmness under fire becomes something that, you know, hardly anybody couldn't make use of in their particular domain of expertise. And I just really applaud the way Rhonda is bringing it not only into the law but into the whole domain of unawareness around racial bias, othering, and things like that, where, you know, you can be a big deal mindfulness practitioner but have no awareness whatsoever of the fact that there's there are elements of suffering going on that, since you don't experience them because you have certain kinds of privileges, they don't actually exist in your universe. And there's a certain way in which, in order for us to grow as a country, we need to begin to see all of the cells of the body politic as of equal value, requiring the same kind of blood supply. And that's something where we need, I think, to wake up. And Rhonda's doing a wonderful job in helping us to understand those kinds of things.
Rhonda, we just have about 30 seconds before I have to take another break here. But in what John's saying, it occurs to me that we talk a lot about unconscious bias, right? And and what mindfulness asks us to do is to bring a level of consciousness to our presumptions about the world. Is that
absolutely?
Is that sort of part of the power of how it can address issues of racial justice?
Absolutely. Creating more awareness of these sort of cognitive ways of categorizing and engaging with other human beings, things that often are happening just below the surface of how we meet each other and arising behind the words and the perceptions. So yes, mindfulness can bring awareness to that. And from that place of awareness, help support us in acting in ways that minimize the harmful effects of bias in our world.
Well, Rhonda McGee and John Kabat-Zinn, I do have to take a very quick break here, so I will do that. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about 40 years of mindfulness in America, because it was back in 1979 that Jon Kabat-Zinn first introduced the idea of mindfulness to Americans, and he joins us today from Springfield, Massachusetts. We're also joined by Rhonda McGee. She's with us from San Francisco, California. She's a professor of law at the University of San Francisco, and her teaching is focused on mindfulness-based stress reduction for interventions for lawyers, law students, and for minimizing social identity bias. And we've got a lot of callers who want to join us, so let me go straight to them. Cynthia is calling from Ipswich, Massachusetts. Cynthia, you're on the air.
Yay. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm, like, breathless over this conversation. It's stunning to me. I'll make it quick. In 40 years, technology has changed, and the ways that we teach and encourage people to be mindful has changed. Apps are a great example of that. When I'm, practicing and trying to get better and better at what I do, sometimes I have a moment of disconnect where I feel like the technology might be getting in the way of what I'm trying to do. And so my question is to both of you, what do you feel is, how much is it a barrier? How much is it a help? I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Cynthia, thank you for your call. John, you want to start?
Sure, I'll start. Well, I have three apps, but, when I started out, the question was this. Like, MBSR is set up as a clinic in the form of an 8-week-long course. And so if we have a class with maybe 30 or 40 medical patients with every conceivable medical diagnosis and ailment you can imagine in this room, and we have a lovely class, and then I send them off for a week, I want them to actually practice the meditation practice during that week. How do I do that in 1979? Well, you have to think back, if you're old enough, to audio cassette tapes and tape recorders. And not everybody even had them in those days, so I arranged to actually get tape recorders for people who didn't have them so that everybody could take home a guided body scan meditation, guided sitting meditation, several mindful hatha yoga programs, and do those. Just push play and do what it says to do on the tape. Come back 6 days later, next week, and we'll talk about it. And so those audio cassette tapes are like the dinosaurs. And then it went to CDs, and now it's moved to, you know, sort of digital downloads and things like that. But the form doesn't really matter in this era. The important thing is the relationship between you and your intention to actually practice using the guidance.
Right.
And the guidance are like training wheels on the bicycle. They're meant to give you the enough of a feel for it so that then you can throw the tape or throw the guidance away and just be your own guide.
Yeah, so if I can just jump in here, the reason why I actually, even though I have this extreme love-hate relationship with my phone, the reason why I welcome the mindfulness apps on the phone is because it's democratizing, right? It allows many
exactly.
more people to have access to something that does still have the risk of feeling a little precious, a little elitist, a little removed from the lives of people of, you know, various socioeconomic status,
totally.
Various racial backgrounds. So it's one of the ways where it puts it into the hands of more people who want it, regardless of who they are, Rhonda. I mean, that's my take
yes.
on it. What do you think about that?
Oh, absolutely. And I would say, you know, we're in a moment right now, as John has said, you know, there's many things that are too early for us to really tell about. And certainly I think that applies with a sort of special kind of truth and emphasis and force to this question of, you know, what is going to be the impact of apps and how exactly can the technologies that are available now really help, you know, expand the reach and you know, accessibility of mindfulness. I'm thinking right now about the fact that new apps are coming out. Just recently, an app came out that specifically makes targets and adapts practices for Black and Indigenous and people of color.
Yeah.
And, you know, really centers the experiences of traditionally marginalized and minoritized people in the framing of the practice, in the kind of way in which they're delivered, and in the teaching community that's highlighted on this particular app that I'm thinking of.
Can I just stop it? I'm so sorry to interrupt you. Forgive me. But I really, you triggered a question in my mind that I wanted to ask you. I don't know if that's being mindful or being impatient, but
that's fine.
But you know,
noticing it is being mindful.
Because we talked a couple of minutes ago about how this idea of awareness in the moment is one of the things that brings a consciousness to understanding our own biases. But what does the same awareness, this mindfulness, what does that do for people practicing that, for people who are on the receiving end of prejudices?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good thing. It's a good question. I mean, first of all, I think we often think, well, there are people who are on the receiving end on the one hand, and there are people who are needing to be more mindful of the way in which they are being biased against others, as if these are two separate kind of, you know, mutually exclusive categories. What mindfulness, I think, can offer is a deeper awareness of the reality that it's not about an identity as one who suffers bias or one who may be biased toward others. It is really exploring the experience of bias and enabling us then to see, wow, any one of us, right, as human beings, we have the kinds of brains and that have psychological habits, patterns, and conditions that can lead us to be biased against people. And while there are patterns, right, in terms of, you know, the distribution of this kind of experience in the world, we live in a culture, for example, where women and minorities and currently right now people who are trying to immigrate into this country from various parts of the world. In other words, we live in a particular time, place, and culture where identities are being manufactured and reified in our world, made more real, made more present. A lot of meaning is attached to them. And as humans, our brains are aware of this, and we are, whether we are conscious of it or not, engaging in this always ourselves too. And so we may or may not be, you know, socially, you know, more vulnerable to experiencing, say, discrimination or racism or sexism as a Black woman in America right now. I certainly know something about how it is that one can see oneself as experiencing discrimination in various ways. But the truth is our brains are constituted in ways that make all of us vulnerable to also carrying biases.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I try to do with the work, and so I know for myself, I grew up in the South, around in a particular time and place, like born in segregated North Carolina, where most of the people around me were African American, small number of whites, and very little opportunity to meet people from other the vast other different cultures and backgrounds in our world. And so moving from the South to San Francisco, California, where I live, I became aware of some of the ways that my background in that particular time and place prefigured me, set me up, made me available to understand how to, how to connect with and relate to people who are white, and certainly people who are black, African American, very different experiences, very much diversity there, and whites. But I was less, aware of, comfortable with, knowledgeable about a lot of different other backgrounds. And so I say that to say, for me, this work of bringing awareness to bias is something that we all can participate in. Mm-hmm. And it's really about how we relate to what the mind is doing with these very subtle ways that we have been conditioned, and we've conditioned ourselves, we've trained ourselves to perceive other people and to kind of make assumptions and presumptions, right? So it's that. It's a really an opening up of that dynamic in any of us for closer awareness and practice, and bringing an ethical commitment to, engaging with intentionality around these subtle ways that we have been formed and we are in the world.
Well, let me turn back to our callers here, and let me turn to Lisa, who's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Lisa, you're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate the work that all of you are doing. My comment, or question and comment, I am a certified health coach through Well Coaches School of Coaching, which is also based in Massachusetts, and have been working primarily with mothers around creating healthy, happy pictures of themselves so that they make choices congruent to that, and have absolutely appreciate the mindfulness component of health coaching and the value of that present moment reflection and positive psychology aspect of what health coaching brings in. In addition to that, I have also worked in chiropractic for 30 years in a practice here in Atlanta, and I have witnessed the increased self-awareness both in myself and in numerous dozens, hundreds, thousands at this point, patients, as they become more self-aware through the integrity of their nervous system. And I'm wondering if there has been, there's a university here in Atlanta, Life University has a positive psychology program and mindfulness practice is taught. And I'm wondering if chiropractic, has it all been a part of your conversation or any aspect of how you've integrated that?
Yeah. Well, Lisa, I'm going to take it back from you there, and forgive me for doing that, but I just want to give John Kabat-Zinn a chance to respond to that. So, John, Lisa asking specifically about chiropractic.
Yeah. And not that I know of, although, of course, chiropractors, are very much attuned to what's going on in the society. So you can't really be a good chiropractor without being mindful, because you're touching another human being. So there are certain ways in which, of course, mindfulness has to be part of the practice of chiropractic. But I don't know of any particular kind of groups or institutions that are promoting mindful, the practice of chiropractic or something like that.
Yeah.
I just don't.
But, John, can you tell us a little bit more about what we do now, about the measurable medical or scientific effects that a mindfulness practice does have on the brain?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, although not being a neuroscientist, I'm probably not the best person to do it. But it's actually remarkable how many neuroscientists are actually interested in studying meditation, whereas, say, even 15 years ago, if you told, as a graduate student in neuroscience, if you told your thesis advisor that you wanted to study meditation, either they'd throw you out of graduate school or they'd say that was a career-ending move. And now it's becoming a major theme within neuroscience, the study, the effect of meditation on the brain. Now, the brain and the mind, we can have conversations forever, much more time than we have on this program.
That's true, because I did say
what the
mind,
difference
didn't
is, because brain and mind. But in terms of the brain, there are major effects that different laboratories are showing of the effects of even 8 weeks or even in some cases, you know, one day of intensive mindfulness practice can have on different areas of the brain, including the frontal cortex and the executive functioning that that subtends, and the hippocampus, which is the center for learning and memory, and the amygdala, which is the threat reaction center, yeah, seems to actually reduce in size in 8 weeks of MBSR, whereas the hippocampus and other regions like the temporal mandibular joint and so forth, area, seem to increase. So there are all these sort of changes that we don't quite understand what they are, but what seems to be happening or what their effects are, but what seems to be happening is that paying attention in this way is driving what's called functional connectivity. It's letting different regions of the brain talk to each other that often maybe don't have such good channels of communication.
I think that is so fascinating. Okay, so we just have...
And therefore integrate experience across different kind of modalities within the brain. And that, of course, is what you want for effective, happy living, is integrative experience rather than, say, being at war with yourself or of, like, the two minds on virtually every subject.
Rhonda, I hear you there. We just have about a minute or so left to go, but go ahead.
Yeah, just to jump in and say as well, it can help with the healing. So yes, while any one of us may experience, for example, bias or and be, you know, vulnerable to brains that are on bias, if you will, there are, you know, for those of us who've suffered discrimination and other kinds of social identity-based pains, mindfulness can also help with the healing, mm-hmm, with the deepening the capacity for self liberation and for, you know, kind of working with some of the legacies of the traumas that we've experienced in our own lives and even historically. So there's a kind of a rich, separate conversation, deeper conversation we could have about the ways that these practices actually do or may, let's say, support healing that is necessary as a consequence of having, you know, lived lives rife with identity-based pain and suffering.
You know, John, we just have a little bit of time left, but I want to note that there are many people out there who might be listening who are saying, this is all well and good, but mindfulness doesn't cure cancer, it doesn't put a roof over your head, it doesn't put food on the table. There are limits to what this practice can achieve. But nevertheless, if there are folks who might be interested in starting, where would they start now?
Well, I'm not going to recommend any apps or even any books, although that's why I write books and do guided meditation kinds of apps and stuff like that. People should actually research it for themselves and trust their intuition to start wherever they feel that there's integrity behind what they're reading or listening to or being invited to explore. Ultimately, you're your own best friend, and we're coming back to the love affair here now. The real meditation practice is not sitting cross-legged like a statue in the British Museum. The real meditation practice is living life as if it really mattered moment by moment by moment. So the real meditation practice, therefore, is life itself. And every moment becomes an opportunity or a new beginning, so to speak, to restructure your relationship with your body, with your mind, with your heart, with your family, with reality itself and the world. And the world really needs us to do this at this particular moment in time.
Well, Jon Kabat-Zinn is the founder of the Center for Mindfulness in Medicine, Healthcare, and Society at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. It has been such a great honor to speak with you. Thank you so much.
It's been wonderful, Meghna.
And Rhonda McGee, professor of law at the University of San Francisco Law School and author of the forthcoming book, The Inner Work of Racial Justice. Professor McGee, thank you.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be in conversation with you both.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.